episode 113, Evidences for the Life of Jesus. This is Matthew, and in this episode I will be reviewing an episode of Frank Turek's Cross-Examined podcast, where Dr. Titus Kennedy discusses discoveries about Jesus that are outside of the biblical texts. Link 1 in the show notes goes to the original episode, which also includes the full list of discoveries. The original episode is dated May 2022. I'll start with Frank's introduction of his guest.
Now, we're not probably going to get to all 20 today, but we'll tell you what we're going to do at the end of the program. We'll get through as many as we can. My friend Titus Kennedy, Dr. Titus Kennedy, has written a fabulous new book, and I read every single word of this book. The title is Excavating the Evidence for Jesus, The Archaeology and History of Christ and the Gospels. And Titus has his PhD from the University of South Africa. He also teaches at Biola University.
Biola University is a Christian university with a statement of faith that staff members are required to adhere to. This in itself means that Frank's guest could lose his job if he dares to publish something that his employers do not like. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that Dr. Kennedy's research is bad or his conclusions wrong. But it does mean that he has motivation to reach specific conclusions from his research. And that fact alone should ring alarm bells, because it means he cannot be considered truly objective or independent. When I searched for other media outlets that had interviewed Dr. Kennedy, all I could find were Christian outlets. I did not find a secular science outlet that had interviewed him on his work. This tells me that his work doesn't reach the intellectual rigour required by secular science sources.
He is connected to the Discovery Institute up there in Washington State. And he also has written a book called Unearthing the Bible. We've had Titus on before. We're going to talk about the top 20 discoveries about Jesus outside the Bible. Here's my friend Titus Kennedy. Titus, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me back on the show, Frank, and thanks for reading every word of my book.
This book gives you so much background as to what's going on, and it's written in a chronological way from the birth of Jesus all the way to the resurrection of Jesus. So there's 8 chapters, and they cover different aspects of Jesus' life. Let's start in chapter 1, Titus. The first discovery, which I found very fascinating, was the place and the nature of Jesus' birth. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Titus?
Sure. So we know from the Gospels that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Specifically, Matthew and Luke talk about that, and there's even a brief reference to knowledge of this idea in the book of John. The early Christians, they remembered where Jesus was born in Bethlehem, not just in the village, but specifically a particular area, supposedly even the cave in which he was born. And they continue to commemorate that over time. And then in the second century, around 130, 135 AD, Emperor Hadrian, who had this campaign to basically erase or syncretize sites associated with Jesus, he went there and he had a Roman shrine built, a shrine to Adonis built. He actually helped preserve the location for the future, because then in the fourth century, that's when Constantine sent his mother, and she had a number of churches built, including the Church of the Nativity.
This failed a fact check. The best I could find was that Hadrian built a shrine to Adonis in Bethlehem to annoy the Christians. But it's not said that it was built at the place of Jesus' birth. Another source says that the cave site alleged to be the place of Jesus' birth was a pre-existing site dedicated to Adonis and discovered in the 2nd century by apologist St. Justin Martyr. It seems that Dr. Kennedy's claims are contradicted by other sources. See links at number 3 in the show notes.
Ironically, by trying to get rid of Christianity, Emperor Hadrian marked spots that helped us identify what Christianity, or the places that were important to Christianity, and Bethlehem's one of them. What about the nature of Christ's birth, that he was born of a virgin? Does anybody say that other than the Bible?
Yeah, actually, there was a 2nd century Roman who was a very harsh critic of Christianity. His name was Celsus, and he goes on a diatribe about various things having to do with Jesus, but he's aware of so many important details about the life of Jesus, including that Jesus was born in a certain Judean village, and this idea of the virgin birth. He knows about the claim of the virgin birth.
Celsus is a 2nd century Greek philosopher. who alleged that the virgin birth claims were fabricated. See links at 4. I really don't see how this helps Dr. Kennedy's case. Referencing a popular lie does not make it true.
Yeah, and obviously it doesn't mean Celsus actually believed in it, but at least he knew that's what the Christians believe. So the place and nature of his birth is something that can be found in non-Christian sources.
Future historians will note that Donald Trump claimed that the election was stolen from him. Great logic there, Frank.
Number 2 in the top 20 is the murderous nature of Herod the Great. How do we know that Herod was the type of guy that might order the killing of the children, all the children in Bethlehem?
This is something that's very obvious from the writings of Josephus, which is our biggest source on Herod. And we see, reading through the life of Herod, that he had many of his political rivals and even family members assassinated. Anyone who he thought was threatening his power. He was really paranoid about this and became even more so near the end of his life. So in this like last 3 years, 7 to 4 BC area of his life, which is where we would place the birth of Jesus, he actually even had some of his sons assassinated because he thought they were trying to usurp his throne. It's really easy to see that he might have several babies who were peasant families in Bethlehem killed because he thought that one of these was going to grow up and then take his throne from him.
Herod does appear to be despotic enough to have his wife and some of her family killed, following allegations against them. Yet historians question the slaughter of the children account, even going so far as to call it fiction. See links at 5. Josephus may indeed have written about Herod, and some of what he wrote is likely less than accurate. That does nothing to establish the person of Jesus as an historical figure. This point moves the dial exactly 0 places.
The third top discovery that I found fascinating, the synagogue where Jesus taught in Capernaum. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is one of the most beautiful ancient synagogues, really, in the land of Israel that's preserved. People go there and they know that Capernaum is associated with Jesus, and they see this synagogue, and initially, they might think, oh, this was the synagogue in which Jesus taught. But it's not. That synagogue is actually underneath the one that you're walking in. So there's this elaborate white stone synagogue that dates to the 4th and 5th century. But directly under that is the 1st century synagogue made of black basalt stone sourced locally. And this is dated to the time of Jesus based on the pottery and the coins that were found in the excavations there.
Okay. So we have a synagogue, built on the site of an ancient synagogue, which likely dates from around the time that Jesus would have been alive. All that tells you is that there exists confirmation of a synagogue from a time in the past when synagogues existed, and that ancient literature from that same period also talks about synagogues. This tells you nothing about Jesus.
Number 4 is Peter's house in Capernaum. We've discovered that as well. What's that about, Titus?
Well, this was a house that originally seemed to have been constructed around the 1st century BC. So Capernaum was getting to be an old and lived-in village by the time of Jesus, didn't start right during his life. But then we see something happens in the archaeology. Around the second half of the 1st century, this building ceases to be used just as a house. It's more of a meeting place. In the middle of the 1st century, we start to see a change there. Second half of the 1st century, it gets converted into more of a meeting house. And we see in the 2nd century, they've plastered the walls. So they're fixing up this building. And this is when graffiti inscriptions start to appear on the walls. And we see things praising Jesus Christ. And there are a couple that mention the name Peter also. And then later on, we see pilgrims, early Christian pilgrims, are going to this house, like Agaria, and she talks about how it was the house of Peter that got changed into a church. But it actually isn't until quite a while after Christianity becomes legalized that there's what we might call an official church building built there. It's not until the 5th century when they build a Byzantine church around it to protect it. But it had a long-standing tradition as one of these early, early house churches, and it was associated with Peter. It seems very plausible. It's about a 10-second walk from the synagogue, which, if you read the Gospels about the location of the synagogue, to Peter's house, it sounds like it's right next to it. So it makes a lot of sense to me.
This is pure speculation. Jesus was not the only person who inspired a following. It is very possible that this could be a location associated to one of those other religious leaders. Dr. Kennedy's conclusion is based on evidence that there are Christians in the past who visited this site, and that there is undated graffiti on the church wall, suggesting they believed it was the site of Peter's house. Religious devotees love to have something tangible to tie to their religions. I get that. But this very desire motivates the kind of blinkered thinking on display here.
Number 5 in the top 20, the Pool of Bethesda from John chapter 5. Tell us about that, Titus.
In John's description there, he says that the Pool of Bethesda had 5 porticos or 5 stoas. And so before this was rediscovered and excavated, scholars weren't really sure what John was talking about. You know, was he making an error? Why this odd 5-sided stoa pool? But when archaeologists finally dug this up, they found that it was 4-sided, like a rectangle, with the 5th stoa going in the middle, dividing it into upper and lower pool sections. And so John, you know, he was there before 70 AD when the city was destroyed. He knew what it was talking about, what it looked like. And he talks about the healing miracle, of course, right? So there's this association with healing going on at the Pool of Bethesda. Well, Hadrian went here too. And what did Hadrian build there? He built a temple to the god of healing, Asclepius. So it seems like he was trying to get people to associate the healing miracle with a Roman deity rather than with Jesus. And yet again, you know, he helped preserve this place. He helped us to understand what the early thoughts and associations were with this pool. And then a Byzantine church was eventually built there after they dismantled this Asclepius shrine.
I'm going to grant that this pool is the same one described in the New Testament, which means I also grant that the story of Jesus healing a lame man at a pool is referring to this pool. Note the context of the healing story in the Gospel of John is that people were there expecting some form of healing miracle, just not from Jesus. There was already a religious healing legend associated with this site. The existence of this pool does nothing to validate any detail about the person of Jesus. So yet again, we have something religious that existed at a time of religious myth and legend. And Christians are desperately trying to use that fact as a hook onto which to pin their own Jesus myths.
The Pool of Siloam, that's number 6 in our list. Tell us about that, Titus.
So the Pool of Siloam was really similar to the Pool of Bethesda. They were both ritual purification pools, at least during the time of Jesus. That's what they were primarily for. And they had these steps, these stone steps where you would walk down into the pool. And that's what we see in both of them. But Siloam, this was not discovered until very recently, because similar to Bethesda, there are kind of 2 sections to the pool. So we knew about this upper pool of Siloam that goes back way back to the time of Hezekiah in the 8th century BC. But we didn't know about this pool, the lower pool, during the time of Jesus until recently when it was kind of unaccidentally discovered by construction. And then your friend, Eli Shukran, excavated there and showed that this was in use during the 1st century, and it went out of use right when the city was destroyed in 70 AD and had been covered since then.
It's a pool. Whoopie-doo. Let's swim.
All right, number 7 on our list of the top 20 discoveries outside the Bible about Jesus is the nature of the town of Bethany where Jesus raised Lazarus. What evidence do we have outside the Bible that this is actually where Lazarus was raised, and also that there was some descriptions about that area that are consistent with what the Bible says?
So if we look at this place archaeologically, we've got evidence of 1st century occupation there.
And how is that even relevant?
And not just of any people, but if we look at some of the ossuaries that were discovered there, we know that these are people who they're Jews with traditional names that we even see not just in the 1st century, but in the Gospels. I mean, there are names of Peter like Simon, and Lazarus and so forth that have been found inscribed on these ossuaries.
Wow, I'm utterly sold. Awesome, dude.
Not saying those are the same ones in the Gospels, but it fits the context. Then there's this first century tomb that has been regarded as the tomb of Lazarus since the time of the early Christians.
People like to create a place with a focus for a certain belief. We know that.
And what's more, there's talk of Simon the leper in his house there in Bethany, right? Well, in the temple scroll from Qumran, Bethany is also mentioned as a place where lepers were, a leper colony. And so we have a lot of connections about Bethany to the ancient archaeology and textual resources.
No one denies that the Bible contains references to places that actually exist at the time the events are supposed to have happened. That never has been an issue. But how does that, in any way at all, validate claims of people rising from the dead?
And was that the first time we've ever discovered verification that leprosy was an issue there in that area in the first century, Titus?
Not even sure how that's relevant. This is supposed to be about Lazarus, not lepers.
So as far as physical remains go, that was excavated at the Tomb of the Shroud. And when they did a skeletal analysis, they found that this person actually had leprosy. And so that was the first physical evidence of it. We had some textual evidence of it before, but physical evidence, yes. And that was a question that had come up.
How about the tomb itself that is attributed to Lazarus? How does, right there in Bethany, how does that comport with what the Gospel of John says?
It's the same general type of tomb, which is one of these rock-cut arcosolium-type tombs with a place for the body to lay. You know, it's carved out of the rock. You would have this big ceiling stone. So it fits. We don't have as detailed of a description of that tomb as we do, say, the tomb of Jesus. Mm-hmm. But it is a first century tomb right there in Bethany, and it does have this extremely ancient tradition. So I would say it's plausible. It's maybe even likely, but we can't say for certain.
I'll confess to being utterly baffled by the credence being applied here. I'm not even going to bother with links. They found a tomb that has a tradition of being associated with the ancient legend of a Lazarus being raised from the dead. And this somehow adds some legitimacy to biblical claims. Holy shit, I could tell you all sorts of legends that are associated with places I grew up. I'm sure many of our listeners can too. Legends that are tangentially associated with the man Jesus do nothing whatsoever to validate any of the ridiculous magical claims associated with him. This point is so pathetic, I'm amazed Frank got through it without laughing. Actually, scratch that. Frank is only ever accidentally funny.
Okay, number 8 of the top 20 discoveries about Jesus outside the Bible is the inscription regarding the place of the trumpeting. What's that, Simon? I mean, Titus, Simon. I'm calling you Simon.
That was discovered in the ruins just off of the Temple Mount, so on like the southwestern side. And it had fallen down from above, so it seems to have been placed up there where there this tower presumably would have been, where there was a trumpeter, and this trumpeter would then make these trumpeting sounds at specific times. So during the night, morning, beginning of Sabbath, things like that, sort of like a clock tower type of idea in medieval times, for example. But I find this really interesting also because if we go to the Gospels, to the night of Jesus's arrest, when Peter denies Jesus 3 times and it talks about the rooster crowing, right? Well, mm-hmm. If we look at that word in Greek, alector, rooster, the rooster crow, that's also a word that is used for the sound of a trumpet. Hmm. And so I think that they're actually talking about the trumpet sound being made, and that is telling everybody that the Sabbath is starting, you know, it's sunrise. And so that may be a little tie in there with the time of Jesus.
This is definitely interesting, and I suspect it's something that not everyone will be aware of. There is a school of thought that suggests that the rooster calling doesn't mean a literal rooster, but is actually a trumpet call that happened every morning, which became known as the rooster call. See links at 7. Now this may be true, and it may even be that archaeological support of that has been found. I have no issue accepting that. This fact does not validate any of the story of Jesus' trial or the alleged denial of Peter. It doesn't even affirm that the man Jesus was tried at all. Cock crowing on the Jesus narrative is a fantastic literary device that inserts additional drama into the court scene. And anyone who has watched anything on ITVX will tell you that court scenes do indeed need a bit of extra drama to spice things up. This tidbit, while interesting, adds nothing of value to any claims about Jesus.
We're on number 9 of the top 20 discoveries about Jesus outside the Bible. This one for me is so fascinating, Titus. It's the Caiaphas ossuary. And first of all, what's an ossuary?
An ossuary is a bone box. So these were carved out of stone. And this was something that was typically used for reburial in the period from about the 1st century BC until 70 AD, although in places like Galilee, they used them into the early 2nd century AD. So this was a type of reburial used for Jews primarily.
And this ossuary, there's, as you write in the book, Excavating the Evidence for Jesus, there's been 1,000 ossuaries or so discovered in that area, in the area around Jerusalem. Or is that the whole Holy Land? I don't know. Is that just Jerusalem or the whole Holy Land?
Most of them are found in Jerusalem, but there's a significant amount in Galilee too. I'm not sure what the exact number is up to now because they keep finding more and more.
Uh-huh. But this one was found in 1990, again by accident, and Caiaphas was inscribed on the side. Why is that significant?
Well, Caiaphas, of course, is well known as being the high priest who was involved in the trial of Jesus.
Out of more than 1,000 ossuaries found in the region over many decades of archaeological digs, they found one that happens to have a name on it that matches the name of someone significant in the Bible. Amazing! Sorry, too much sarcasm? Let's suppose, though, that these are in fact the actual bones of the Caiaphas mentioned in the Bible. What does that tell you about the life of Jesus? Nothing, and that's the problem. This is Frank getting all excited about archaeological evidence for the life of Jesus while presenting archaeological finds that tell us nothing about the life of Jesus. Typical Christian apologetics.
Number 10 on our list here is another fascinating discovery, the James ossuary. What's that about, Titus?
The James ossuary is one of these items, these artifacts that was involved in the antiquities trial that went on for a decade. And so the James ossuary got severely scrutinized, which I think was a good thing. Because at the end of the trial, these artifacts were actually given back to the owner, and he wasn't charged with forgery. And all sorts of experts looked at this ossuary as well as other artifacts, and many of them came out saying that it looked like it was authentic. It seems authentic. You know, initially, this team from the IAA was saying that it was a forgery, or at least the inscription was a forgery, but the geologic test showed that the ossuary was legit. It was an ancient ossuary from the Jerusalem area. But when they examined the patina, which is the ancient residue in the letters of the inscription, they found that was ancient, and that fit with Jerusalem tombs of the Roman period. So then it shifted to, all right, just this last part of the inscription is a fake, and it was added later. But then they found that there was still patina, ancient patina residue in some of the letters from the final name also. And what is that final name? All right, so the whole inscription in Aramaic reads, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And that's why this thing got so much attention, because just looking at that, if you know anything about history and the Gospels, then you understand that this is probably talking about James, the leader of the Jerusalem church, and Jesus Christ. Now, what's so odd about that inscription is that in the normal protocol for ossuary inscriptions, usually it's just the person's name and then their father's name, or sometimes the person's name, their place of origin, or their profession, right? You don't have this three-part inscription, hardly ever. When you do have something like that, it's for a reason. It's because whatever is added on is very important. So in all of the other ossuary inscriptions that have been discovered, there's only one other one that mentions the brother. So we know that the brother is really important here. He's tacked on to the end as this additional identifier. And who do we know that is a James brother of Jesus, or a Jesus with a brother James? Well, the only one that we know about in first century Jerusalem.
Due to poor quality recording of other families, the only James and Jesus brothers you know about are those in the Bible. So it must be referring to them. Big sigh. Links at 9 if you're curious. The Caiaphas links are at number 8. Remember, this artifact is authenticated by the Israel Antiquities Authority, and there is no chance at all that they'll be motivated to promote tourism to their corner of the world. And we all know that religious hunger for artifacts is a great driver for tourism. The authenticity of the James ossuary has been hotly debated, and those with religious motivation err on the side of authenticity, while those with scientific motivation err on the side of caution. Whoever is right, all that this tells us is that James, one of the fathers of Christianity, had human bones, while those of his brother Jesus were not found in the same location. Hardly an earth-shattering revelation, given that the tomb had been damaged by looters and earthquakes. So yet again, while potentially interesting, this find tells us nothing about the life of Jesus. Oh, and quick sidebar, there is also the highly controversial ossuary of Jesus, which has some interesting names on it. No links in the show notes, but have a look at that one if this sort of thing really interests you. I wonder why Frank didn't talk about that one.
Number 11 in the top 20 is the Gates of Hades, or the Gates of Hell, found in Caesarea Philippi. What's this about?
So in Caesarea Philippi, you have this area that was an ancient temple, or a shrine, really, to Pan, this Greek Hellenistic god with kind of the half goat body there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also this temple to Zeus there. And then Herod built another temple there to Augustus. So it's very, very pagan. And it's that place that Jesus takes his disciples, and they're talking to him, and it's the location actually where he asks, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter responds. Well, one of the things that Jesus talks about there is the rock, you know, the Petra, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look in this area, it's this huge cliff face, very reminiscent actually of the site of Petra in some ways, because it's this big rock cliff where all these things are carved out. But then he also talks about the Gates of Hades. Well, right next to all these carvings associated with the Temple of Pan, there's this cave that descends down into the earth, and there's a spring in there. And this is something that probably went back even to Canaanite times and would have been regarded as a cult site and an entrance to the underworld, Hades. And so when Jesus talks about the gates of Hades will not overcome, I think that he's using a word picture there based on the geography, the location, the structures that are around him.
It's amazing. You'll see it too when we go to Caesarea Philippi. This, the gates of hell, they're right there, the gates of Hades.
See link at 10 for more detail on this location. What I find odd about this alleged evidence is that it is called evidence because Jesus, apparently, said something that appears to refer to this location. A great many fictional stories contain characters that mention real places. Now, I know Frank has a reputation for scraping scum off the bottom of a barrel, but this is broken nail and splinters in your fingers level. Yikes, Frank.
All right, number 12 is that the miracles of Jesus are admitted by some non-Christian sources that he's a miracle worker. What do you mean by that?
Oh, this one better be good. Don't disappoint us, please, Frank.
So if we go back to some of the earliest attestations of the miracles of Jesus, or mention of them outside of the New Testament, first and second century, we see that these people are not saying that Jesus didn't perform miracles. They're saying that he did perform miracles. They're giving various perspectives about them based on their beliefs or worldview. So we've got Justin Martyr, who writes a letter to the emperor saying that you can go to your own Roman records in the Acts of Pilate, and you can see that Jesus performed some of these miracles.
See link at 11 for reference to the letter mentioned here. What I find odd about this claimed source is that the guest talks about a Christian apologist writing a letter to an emperor in which it is stated that there are documents containing evidences for the acts of Jesus. Huh. Why not go direct to the source and detail those sources? Pointing to people talking about them doesn't add any credence whatsoever. But I guess this is what impresses Christians.
And we look at, for example, Celsus. He talks about this, and his explanation is that when Jesus was in Egypt, so he knew about that as a young child, that Jesus acquired miraculous powers, and then he went back to Judea and performed miracles.
Celsus came up in a previous item. See links at 4 for that, in addition to links at 12 for what is being referenced here. Remember, Celsus is 2nd century, so about 150 years after Jesus. All he would have access to is the legends that are circulating about Jesus, and probably others too. It doesn't shock me that there are some ancient stories about people who do sorcery. I'm interested in how we can possibly extract the truth from these stories. Having others talk about them doesn't increase the truthfulness of these legends. There are a great many retellings of the legends of Merlin, yet no one believes he actually did magic or sorcery. The same criticality should be applied to Jesus. But Christians think they're being honest when they think that references to Jesus doing sorcery lend any sort of validity to the miracle claims in the Bible. They're not, and they don't.
The Judaism's leaders opposed to Jesus are saying it's from the devil. Celsus, he's saying it's magic Jesus learned in Egypt. And then we go to Josephus, and he just mentions in passing that Jesus performed works, and he uses this Greek word that can be describing incredible works. Okay, it sounds like he's talking about miracles. He doesn't make a comment on it, which is what Josephus often does. He just reports what people are saying. He doesn't make a comment on it, but he's also doesn't say that this didn't happen.
Does he mean the Josephus passage that is considered a forgery? See link at 13. I actually feel embarrassed for Frank and his guest now.
Mm. So we've got four sources from four different perspectives. None of them say the miracles didn't happen. They're all affirming they did. They're just explaining the source differently.
None of them give concrete evidential validation either. We're simply referring to hearsay here. This is really poor.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
13, the fearful nature of Pilate. Why was Pilate afraid of upsetting the Jews?
We got to look at the historical context of Pilate himself and what's going on in the Roman Empire at this time. So Pilate was a pretty typical Roman governor. He ruled in Judea for 10 years, which was actually a really long time in comparison to most governors. And yet he obviously also had his issues with the local populace. He got into trouble multiple times. By the time we get to the trial of Jesus in 33 AD, we know of at least three situations, probably four situations actually, where Pilate has made the locals mad by something he's done. Displaying shields with Caesar's name, Roman eagles, using money from the temple treasury to build an aqueduct. And then there's the thing that's talked about in the Gospels, mixing the blood of Galileans with their sacrifices. So we don't know exactly what that was, but it sounds like he probably had some people killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to 31 AD is the Sejanus affair, the assassination of Sejanus, who is the head of the Praetorian Guard. And he came into that position in 26, same time as Pilate. Tiberius goes to the island of Capri, and Sejanus starts amassing power for himself and acting, being the acting emperor in many ways. Well, eventually, this gets back to Tiberius, that Sejanus has aspirations to become the emperor. And so he is assassinated, but not just him. A lot of members of his family and his political associates and friends. So if there is any kind of connection that Pilate had to Sejanus, he would be very concerned. But even if he didn't, he still would be, because he could see what the emperor was going to do to people that got on his bad side. So in John, it records that if you free this man, you are no friend of Caesar. So that was political terminology for someone who had favor, political favor of the emperor. They're threatening him and saying they're going to send an official delegation to complain, which had already happened to Pilate. Well, that did happen one more time in 36. He had an official complaint that went from the Samaritans, and he was recalled to Rome by the emperor. Now, Tiberius died before Pilate got back, so he was saved essentially because of that. But it makes perfect sense that in 33, he would have just given in to their demands rather than be exiled, maybe even executed after losing his position.
Sounds fascinating and typically Roman despotic behavior for the time period. Apart from the dates, what the fuck has this got to do with Jesus? And what does it even validate about Jesus?
So he was aligned with this guy Sejanus, who was already executed, and he was worried he might be next. How about number 14 in our top 20? The nature and place of the burial and resurrection of Jesus, basically the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. How good of evidence do we have for that, Titus?
I think we have excellent evidence for that being the tomb of Jesus. So, of course, there's the ancient tradition, which is very strong there. Mm-hmm. And I would say it goes back to the first century, because for Christians, this was the most important event and the most important location. It's where Jesus resurrected and left the tomb. And so they remember that. And Jerusalem wasn't a big city at that time, and people generally didn't move from place to place so often like they do now. So they would tell it to their kids and their grandkids, and, oh yeah, down the street, there's the tomb of Jesus. Well, we go to Hadrian yet again. So when he rebuilds Jerusalem as Aelia Capitolina in about 135, he builds a huge double temple to Jupiter and Venus over the tomb of Jesus, because, again, he wants to erase the memory of Jesus and syncretize these things into Roman religion. That was his tactic now for defeating Christianity.
So the Romans had the habit of quashing any kind of rebellion so that they could more efficiently progress their empire building. Yeah, we know this happened. So what?
But yet again, what's he do? He preserves the location.
And again, so what? How does that help change the myth and the legend of magic that happened in location become true? It doesn't.
And so when Constantine's mother goes there and his architect goes there, they ask the local Christian leaders, where's the tomb of Jesus? They know that it's underneath the temple. So they dismantle the temple, and there's this rock-cut tomb there. And that's what they build the edicule around. So if we look into things archaeologically, that area was outside the walls of Jerusalem in 33 AD. It had been a quarry that then got turned into a garden in the first century BC and started to be used as a graveyard. There are other first century tombs found very close to this tomb of Jesus. When we look at the tomb itself and the architecture of it, we see that it is a single chamber, rock cut, Arcosolian tomb. It's got a burial bench, and it would have been sealed with this big stone. That's all specifics that we see in the Gospels also.
This is cherry picking of legends to suit a preferred narrative. It is also possible to construct an account where the body of Jesus is dumped into a communal pit, since that is the common way criminals were treated after being punished.
Number 15 in our top 20 pieces of evidence outside of the Bible about Jesus is the Nazareth inscription. Tell us about that.
This is a stone inscription that turned up in Nazareth. We don't know if that's where it was originally placed, but could have been. It's a Greek inscription that states it's an edict of Caesar. So the normal way this would have been done is the emperor wrote a letter, and in this letter he is giving a new law. And then they take that letter, the governor and have it inscribed in stone so everybody can read it, put it in the town square or something like that. So this one talks about there's a new law and the penalty is death. And what do you have to do to get the death penalty? Well, it says that if anybody goes in and disturbs a sepulcher sealed tomb and steals the body with wicked intent, they can get the death penalty. So it's an ultra specific law that's talking about the same type of rock cut tomb that Jews used, and specifically that was the type of the tomb of Jesus that's sealed by a big stone. And it's not just, you know, breaking the tomb or taking items out of it. It's stealing the body with wicked intent. Now, if we go to Matthew 28, we see that the story that the Roman soldiers were told to spread was that the disciples had come and stolen the body of Jesus. And it says that that story is spread to this day.
This is actually quite an interesting find. See link to that 15. And it is obvious why Christians are excited about it, despite the inscription specifically mentioning damage and disturbance, neither of which are reported to have happened to Jesus' alleged tomb. This is also a case of very different methodologies being used by the secular scientists examining the artifact and the Christian apologists commenting on the conclusions. As always, those with a particular religious position to defend manage to find an answer that supports their preferred religious position. Out of the 20 items that Frank promises in his guest's book, they only discuss 15. My thoughts after going through these are that they are mostly very poor and weak, and the occasional one that could be interesting does absolutely nothing to validate any of the divine claims attached to Jesus. They could just as easily be made off the back of a legendary account, and that is exactly the problem with the gospel narratives, and why I continue to be atheistic in my approach, as well as highly critical of apologetic excuses. As always, thanks for listening, and until next time, be reasonable. You have been listening to a podcast from Reason Press. Do you have any thoughts on what you've just heard? Do you have a topic that you would like us to cover? Please send all feedback to reasonpress@gmail.com. You might even appear on an episode. Our theme music was written for us by Holly. To hear more of her music, see the links in our show notes.